From the Center for European Reform, this is the CER podcast.
Posons-nous sérieusement la question de l'avenir que nous voulons et ayons tous ensemble le courage de le construire.
Für uns in Deutschland ist das Bekenntnis zum vereinten Europa Teil unserer Staatsräson.
A strong united Europe is a necessity for the world because an integrated Europe remains vital to our international order.
This is the moment for Europe to lead the way towards a new vitality.
Welcome to this Centre for European Reform podcast on European defence. I'm Charles Grant, the director of the CER, and I'm joined today by my colleague Luigi Scazzieri, who is an expert on European defence questions and will be publishing in a couple of days a paper on this subject. The reason, Luigi, why we're talking about this today is because European defence is very much on the EU's agenda. Mrs. von der Leyen is trying to make it a priority for her second spell in office, assuming she serves a second term. And the background to this, of course, is that because Russia has invaded Ukraine, Europeans are starting to feel insecure, particularly those who live in the eastern half of the continent. They worry about Europe's ability to stand up to Russian aggression. We have NATO, of course, but NATO is a little bit under question with the possibility of a return to office of Donald Trump in the United States. And Trump has been pretty critical of NATO in the past, at least when he was in office the first time. So because of the threat of Russia and the worries about Trump, everybody's saying, shouldn't the Europeans do more for themselves on defence? President Emmanuel Macron of France has been saying this for some time. Maybe circumstances are evolving so that more people will listen to what he's saying. But if we do spend more on defence, where is the money to come from? And one of the questions is, should the EU itself play a role at EU level rather than leave it to the member states or just leave it to NATO? And what role specifically should the Commission play, if any? So perhaps we could start off, Luigi, by saying a little bit about these two initiatives that have come out recently from the European Commission, the EDIS and the EDIP. Would you like to tell us a bit about them and what the Commission is trying to do with them?
Yeah, of course, Charles. And maybe just to take a tiny step back first, the EU's involvement in defence, and at least the European Commission's involvement in defence, which is often what we mean when we talk of EU involvement in defence, is de facto limited to the defence industrial field. And it goes back a few years with the Commission becoming involved since 2021 in defence research and development efforts with a fairly large fund, the European Defence Fund. There were precursors to it, but they were very small, whereas the European Defence Fund is a fairly sizable defence budget. And then with the conflict in Ukraine, with Russia's invasion, the Commission became more involved also in trying to foster joint procurement with a very small tool named DERPA, and also in essentially directly subsidizing defense industries so they could ramp up production of ammunition. And then what really makes the discussion quite complicated is that as another pillar of EU efforts, you have efforts that don't fit under the Commission, but are more in the hands of member states. And that is essentially the European Peace Facility, which is an off-budget tool that the EU has used to essentially pay member states to reimburse them for the value of the equipment they had provided to Ukraine, and now also to jointly procure ammunition. And there's a discussion going on about how it may be used. So I think when we talk about European defence, it's worth bearing in mind that it's a fairly complex picture, and that in no way is the EU itself, not with these member state driven initiatives and not with the Commission driven initiatives, involved in the business of replacing NATO, which is irreplaceable when it comes to any kind of operational element of deterrence in particular. So after that preamble, to go back to your question, yes, the Commission put forward two papers. One of them is a policy paper, the European Defence Strategy, and the other one is the sort of implementing legal document that will become an EU regulation or a defence industrial programme. And the idea behind these two documents is to give more coherence to the initiatives in the defence industrial field of the previous few years. And as the Commission puts it, to go from emergency measures to defence readiness.
And could you say a bit more specifically, Luigi, I gather that some of the elements that are in these two documents are to have an element of subsidy to make it worthwhile for European governments or companies to collaborate. There's an element of EU subsidy to kind of incentivize them to cooperate because the EU wants to see more cooperation. There's an element of guarantee so that if the EU itself or somebody paid for by the EU would guarantee to actually buy the armaments produced by these joint procurement efforts. Could you explain exactly what the Commission's getting at?
Of course. So maybe the starting point, I think, is joint planning, because the Commission's argument, and one which is broadly accepted, is that a huge part of the reason why European defence is in a bit of a messy situation and why Europeans aren't really able to produce the equipment they need, the reason why they missed the target of supplying Ukraine with 1 million shells by the end of this month, is that member states don't really plan in a coordinated way. They spend their defense budgets separately. And as a result of that, the European defense industry is also quite fragmented. This leads Europeans to buying mainly off the shelf from other countries, particularly American supplies. And the Commission's idea is really to coordinate spending and spend more in Europe. It proposes to do this in several different ways. So one of the elements is to try to make planning more coherent so that opportunities to cooperate are identified at an earlier stage. And the idea is to set up a so-called Defense Industrial Readiness Board that would bring together the member states, the EU institutions, the European Defense Agency. And by bringing together these key defense players in a very structured format, push them to work together. The board wouldn't have powers to force countries to do anything, but it could, for example, push defense very much up the agenda, help countries define capabilities on which cooperation is more promising, but also exchange information and even monitor the flows of critical raw materials, for example. And then another pillar of what the Commission has proposed is a set of incentives to push member states to work together more. This copies some of the already existing initiatives, but is supposed to expand them. So you would have a so-called structure for European armament program that would be a new legal structure, as it were. Member states would put common projects under such a structure, and in return for doing so, they would get significant funding bonuses. For example, if they agree to jointly own the equipment they procure through such a structure, or if they agree to a common approach to exports, the lack of which is often a barrier for cooperative armaments projects. So the idea here is to put forward a set of incentives. And then you have a third sort of pillar that's about making sure that defense industry can produce what it needs to produce so that it can produce more quickly, that it can maintain production levels high, even if demand falls. And the idea here is that the Commission would again copy the logic of what it's been doing so far for ammunition, but expanding it also to other capability areas. It also wants to have the ability to call a crisis state if member states agree. And that would then allow the Commission, in consultation with the member states, to, for example, force firms, including civilian firms, to prioritize production of weapons if needed, or indeed to make it harder for member states to exercise what the Commission argues is an undue level of control over the flow of basic components across the single market. So it's helpful, I think, to think of the Commission's initiatives in those two pillars, broadly speaking, one aimed at member states and one aimed more at industry, two forms of subsidy with flanking regulatory measures. There's also, you know, and maybe we'll go into this later, but a discussion about financing for defense industry, which has trouble accessing private capital. The Commission is aware of this and would like the European Investment Bank to change its mandate, for example. So there's ideas about how limited EU funds may be in a typical, I must say, Commission way, may be leveraged into bigger funding as well to then lend to defense industry again to help them out.
Thank you. Just before we move on to the money side of things, just very briefly, I gather that the Commission's recent proposals build on two existing rather small kind of pilot programs, one called ASAP, which is about getting ammunition for Ukraine, and the other called ADERPA, which is about common procurement. Have these small programs been a success, and are there lessons to be learned from the way they're running?
I think, yes, the Commission's idea is to essentially copy the logic of these programs, but to ramp them up. So at the moment, ADERPA is only 300 million and ASAP is 500 million. I think it's difficult to define them as success, largely because they took so long to agree. ADERPA was supposed to be about helping member states fill urgent capability gaps to refill their own stocks and to help Ukraine. But it took a very long time to iron through the different issues. In particular, there were lots of arguments about third country involvement in EU defense. And so no, it didn't meet its original target, to be honest. It served more as, I would argue, testing ground for what could be the EU's involvement. And ASAP is different, I think. It's more successful, but there the logic behind giving money directly to the defense industry, it's simpler than pushing countries to work together on procurement, because it's harder to get countries to trust each other, to agree to common requirements, and so on. So you would need a more substantial financial incentive, I suppose.
Right. Okay. Well, just moving on to money for a second. I gather from the documents the Commission has produced, there's only 1.5 billion euros available. It's more than ASAP and ADERPA, but it's not massively more. 1.5 billion euros available for this new defence industrial programme. Is that going to be enough to make a difference? And I did see, you mentioned already that the European Investment Bank, the possibility of them being able to finance defence projects has been put forward by the Commission. I also saw in their documents they talked about, they said possibly using the profits of frozen Ukrainian assets to help this defence ideas. But is there enough money for these programmes to make a difference, do you think?
I mean, in a sense, the answer is clearly no, because 1.5 billion, especially when it comes to procurement, is very, very little. You would need tens of billions to really make a dent. I would say, you know, the 1.5 billion is about refinancing, keeping existing EU efforts. So what we talked about before, ASAP and ADERPA, going until the next EU budget, because these programs are supposed to expire in 2025. So at the moment, the Commission's priority is just to keep that going until you can start a discussion about what will be in the next budget. And they very much hope that there will be much more money than just the 1.5 billion. It's true, there's this idea of using the profits of the Russian frozen assets. I think if member states agree, that would probably be a use of the Russian assets that makes a very immediate difference if the funds are directed to Ukraine, to Ukraine's prospects, rather than using them, for example, for financial assistance. But it doesn't seem to me like that debate has been settled. There's a lot of other ways in which the profits of the Russian assets could be used. And it's not a given that the member states will agree to feed them into a commission program. There is a separate discussion that's going to take a long time, I think, to run its course about joint EU borrowing for defense to direct more money to these programs. And it's noteworthy that there have been some frugal countries like Estonia and indeed Denmark to a degree that seem open to this idea that was, you know, more of a French and commission idea to start off with. But Germany remains very skeptical, and not just skeptical, but there's a hard obstacle in the form of the Constitutional Court ruling that the post-pandemic recovery fund was a one-off. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how that can be overcome and whether we will ever get joint EU borrowing for defense. So what I think the Commission hopes is that in general, the fact that Europe is in a very different position to what it was when the last EU budget was agreed would mean that member states would be more minded to direct money to defense and therefore to give more of a proper budget to these initiatives in the next period. Having said that, I very much doubt that you would get to a figure of tens of billions anyway. So I think EU defense is very much of a long-term project. And a lot of the ideas that the Commission is putting ahead are not really going to see the light of day in the near term, but in the long term, there's a good chance that they might.
Yes, they're not going to make much difference to the battlefield of Ukraine in 2024 or 2025, probably.
No.
So having recently spoken to the Germans about Macron's idea, supported by Mrs. Kallas in Estonia, that the EU should borrow 100 billion euros on the model of the Recovery and Resilience Facility to fund defence. The German reaction to that was unprincipled on a family podcast, I have to say, the reaction of senior Germans on that. Let's move on to a little bit to the politics of all this, Luigi. When I was in Brussels recently, just a couple of days before the Commission produced the documents we're talking about, I have to say, talking to some of the member states, there was a lot of hostility to the idea that the Commission should play a role in Europe and even defence industry, let alone defence policy. To my surprise, even from the French, I mean, the French certainly believe in the EU playing a role in defence, but they don't want the Commission to get involved. They're not in favour of a European Defence Commissioner, as Mrs. von der Leyen has suggested there should be a European Defence Commissioner. The Germans and the Italians, too, are quite hostile to this idea. And I think one of the reasons I heard why from various member states' representations in Brussels was that they think the Commission has a natural tendency to empire build and to meddle in things that aren't where it doesn't have expertise. And they don't want to see the Commission meddling in defence industrial matters, let alone defence policy. So they think the Commission isn't an expert on this, really. And then also they think the EU just doesn't have enough money to make much of a difference, as we've already discussed a moment ago. And therefore, if the money's coming from the member states, it makes sense for the member states to take a lead, even on defence industrial questions, where one might have thought that the Commission could actually take a lead. So I think the Commission is going to face quite a lot of opposition to its ideas that it should play a significant role. Of course, Thierry Breton, the very influential French commissioner whose responsibilities include the defence industry, is pushing the Commission to play a big role in defence industrial coordination and policy and expansion. But I'm not sure his own government is necessarily supporting some of what he's doing. But tell me, how do you see the politics of it, Luigi? And tell us, what is the Commission's answer to its critics? Why should the Commission play a role in these defence industrial matters? What added value can it bring?
So I think it's correct that there's a lot of issues that member states have, in particular with some of the proposals that the Commission has come up with, not only with its current proposals, but also with some of the proposals over the past few years. Because basically anything that I think smacks of the Commission becoming involved in what are seen as national sovereign decisions, including about defense industry, is a no. And so I suspect that a lot of the proposals in EDIP on, for example, things like the Commission becoming involved in follow-on orders of military equipment, perhaps the idea of about open contracts, which is one of the other Commission ideas, anything that relates to sharing classified information with other member states or indeed with the Commission on a non-voluntary basis, all these ideas are going to be non-starters. And I think the fact that the Commission has been so proactive in putting them forward perhaps hides the fact that actually member states don't mind a bit of EU cash subsidizing their defense industry, or many member states. And here's the problem, that of course defense industry within the EU is concentrated in the largest member states and in Sweden. And the problem is all the other member states kind of ask themselves, well, what's in it for us if we're just, by agreeing to such EU programs, subsidizing the industry of larger member states? Then there's constant discussion about the degree to which third countries can be involved in EU defense, the degree to which they can benefit from EU funding, with France being extremely kind of strict about this, whereas others like Italy, Sweden, Germany being much more open. But I think ultimately a lot of the issues are going to be worked through as they have been in the past. And of course, the Commission's not going to get anywhere near what it wants. But I do think we're going to end up with an EDIP, probably a small one, and that it will continue in the next MFF. But that it will principally have a logic of providing EU subsidies to firms and countries that agree to work together, rather than being a coercive instrument.
Well, you mentioned the issue of the French belief that money should be spent on European armaments. This has been a long-running argument affecting European defence cooperation for over many years. And we've seen it recently with the European peace facility. The French wanted to be spent only on European armaments. We've seen it on EDIRPA, which we discussed already. And there's been some confusion because recently when Mr. Pavel, the Czech president, proposed a new fund to get armaments quickly for Ukraine, Macron said he was okay with it, some of the money being spent outside the EU if it got weapons to Ukraine quickly. But then back in Brussels, French diplomats were still defending the line that the European peace facility has to be spent only on European armaments. This, of course, has implications for whether Britain can be involved in European defence or not. How do you see this argument about EU only or not EU only when it comes to spending defence euros, Luigi?
So I think the French position is one that's best understood by making a distinction between the long term and the short term. So it seems to me that Macron and France are generally now open to spending some EU funds from the peace facility in terms of Ukraine's urgent needs, also by sourcing equipment outside the EU. But they remain adamant that at some stage the aim of spending EU money needs to be to make the EU more able to stand on its own feet, and therefore to give money to foster industrial production within Europe. As you say, it's a long-running argument that is about ultimately efficiency, immediate efficiency versus resilience. I think that there's already been pushback against some of the Commission's proposals in EDIP because they're very restrictive towards the participation of third countries by Sweden. And I expect that that will be one of the main arguments going ahead. One of the key things to understand is that there's several layers to this. Part of the debate is about whether third countries and third country firms and non-associated countries, because there's some third countries that can be associated to EU tools, like Norway, by virtue of being a member of the EEA, and going ahead, Ukraine, basically just by virtue of being Ukraine and the fact that it's under threat and needs as much help as it can get. But one level is about the ability of these non-associated countries to participate in EU programs and benefit from EU funding. And then there's another discussion about third country firms and third country participating in EU programs without benefiting from EU funding. And I think everyone recognizes that, of course, to benefit from EU funds, you need to contribute in some way. But what's not often understood is that there are rules that prevent third countries de facto from even being involved. And those are rules that relate to their ability to exercise export controls over any jointly developed products, and that also relate to the intellectual property from any jointly developed products. And these are rules that are very restrictive and very uncommon, or indeed uncommon, yes, for cooperative armaments programs. So countries like the UK, I think, will need to really engage very strongly, in particular if there is a future Labour government, with member states that are sympathetic to the involvement of third countries, to make them understand that there is a problem with the current rules and that they need to essentially be clarified, ideally. And the UK will be very much helped in that regard if it takes a much more constructive approach towards EU defence tools in general.
I think what you're saying, Luigi, and I draw this as a conclusion, that unless the current rules change, it's going to be very hard for the British defence industry to be significantly involved with the joint European armaments projects. That's right?
That's correct. And it seems to be the case that on the EU side, there is no real recognition of the fact that it's a net loss not to involve the UK. And that is very much a consequence of the bad blood that still exists from Brexit.
Right. Fine. Well, thank you, Luigi. Let's just conclude now with a little quiz, which we don't often have in CR podcasts, but I'm going to quiz you on some of the acronyms that appeared in the Commission press release for the EDIS and the EDIP. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. You have to tell me, Luigi, what they stand for. And I hope you'll do well in the quiz. We won't do EDIS and EDIP because we covered them already. What is EDTIB? What is EDTIB?
The European Defence Industrial Base.
Almost. European Defence Technological and Industrial Base. I'll give you half a point for that. Not a whole point. What is CARD? C-A-R-D.
The Coordinated Annual Review on Defence.
Correct. 1 point. What is CDP?
The Capability Development Plan.
What is PESCO? P-E-S-C-O.
Permanent Structured Cooperation.
Okay. What is FAST? F-A-S-T.
Fund for the Acceleration of Supply Chain Transformation.
Excellent. And finally, what is SEAP? S-E-A-P.
The Structure for European Armaments Programme.
Well, you've done very well, Luigi. You got every question right, except for one which you got half right. So I think you passed the commission test on knowing your defence industrial acronym. Thanks to you, Luigi, and thanks to others for listening. We'll see you soon at the next CR podcast. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you for listening to the CER podcast. If you have any feedback for us or want to leave suggestions for a future episode, then you can find us on Twitter @CER_EU.